This is David Newman, author of Do It Selling, 77 Instant Action Ideas to Land Better Clients, Bigger Deals, and Higher Fees. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which has been named by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others, as one of the top marketing podcasts. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message that you're a listener, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. All right, let's get on with the show. Today we welcome back David Newman to talk about his book, Do It Selling, 77 Instant Action Ideas to Land Better Clients, Bigger Deals, and Higher Fees, published by Amplify. David Newman is a keynote speaker and professional services sales expert who works with consultants, coaches, and speakers who want to land better clients, bigger deals, and higher fees. David is the author of Do It Marketing, which was featured on episode 181 of the Marketing Book Podcast in 2018, and he's the host of the podcast, The Selling Show. David has been working at the intersection of marketing, sales, and professional services for over 30 years. His clients and audiences have included Accenture, KPMG, Oracle, IBM, Microsoft, and 44 of the Fortune 500. David and his team have worked with over 1,800 successful consultants and business coaches. David has been featured and quoted in the New York Times, Investor's Business Daily, Forbes, MSN, Fast Company, Sales and Marketing Management, Selling Power, CNBC, Entrepreneur Magazine, and the Marketing Book Podcast.
Shut up! Will you shut up?
And interesting fact, David and I have the same breed of dog, English Cream Golden Retrievers. David, congratulations on Do It Selling, and welcome back to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Douglas, we are just in the intro, and I have never had more fun being on a show. Thank you for having me back.
Welcome back, friend.
Well, I will include pictures of your dog, your beautiful dog, Gracie, and my dog, Monty, on this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And if the listener hears some barking in the background, it's going to be a parallel conversation going on between Monty and Gracie. So just so people know about that. Now, one thing I need to mention, every episode of the Marketing Book Podcast always has a new listener. This may be the first time a listener is listening, and I'm glad you're here. And you may be wondering, wait a minute, this is the Marketing Book Podcast. Why is there a book on sales on the Marketing Book Podcast? Good question. And the reason why is because the most successful marketers are the ones that have the deepest insights into sales, what the sales team is doing, and what the buyer is thinking and doing, and what the friction is. I see this all the time. And if you are a marketer who has no idea who your salespeople are or who they're selling to or what's going on, there's a risk that you might be an arts and crafts party planner who works in the make it pretty department. And I should mention, David, that Jeb Blunt, who you probably know, you probably run into him in the speaking circuit. He writes lots of sales books. He has told me that he gets more business from marketing people than from any other role at his clients. In other words, it's not the CEOs and not the heads of sales. It's the marketing people who are doing things quite well, and they realize that their sales colleagues need some help. So one thing that I know a lot of listeners do is they'll listen to these interviews about sales books, and they'll buy some. Marketers, you need to be reading at least one sales book a year. And then sometimes they'll give them to their sales team. So read a book, share it with your sales team. If you think it's good, make sure to read it first. And they'll start to perceive you differently, and you will be more effective. Now, I noticed that the book is endorsed by a number of authors who I have had the honor of interviewing, including Jay Baer, John Jantz, David Premer, and Phil M. Jones. So major street cred there, Mr. Newman, and many others as well. So
thank you. Yes, it's nice to have a community of smart friends.
I tell you, I think that's why I do this podcast. I get to talk to smart people like you. So let me tell you one thing, though. You are a professional speaker, and amongst other things. And every time an author who's written a book and has been on the Marketing Book Podcast, this is without exception, their books are always excellent. And I once asked Jay Baer about this, not to drop a name, but I saw him at a conference in Cleveland, and I said, you know, Jay, it seems to me that everybody who's like a professional speaker, they always have excellent books. Is it like a comedian that works on the material for a while before they roll it out? He said, oh, yeah. He said, I don't write a book until I've given the presentation about 25 times because I need to keep improving it. And what I mean by all that also is like Joey Coleman, he's another example, where they just the speakers have such a good sense of the audience, of the timing, and the pacing, and keeping things moving along. As a matter of fact, Joey Coleman, on his last book, Never Lose a Customer Again, he told me that he went into the sound studio and just spoke the book for 12 hours, and then they transcribed it, and that became the first draft.
How about that?
Yeah, but it's just, I mean, it made my point. So this book has, gosh, I think 20 parts. And it's beautifully designed, I should add, and very nice paper stock. I mean, I notice these things. So it's 77 very short chapters, moves right along as I was talking, and it has a bonus list of 101 sales tips at the end, each delivered as a three-word reminder of the ideas in the book. Talk about over-delivering, Mr. Newman.
It is action-packed. I think bang per page is set at maximum.
Yes, and a lot of fun. Great sense of humor in your writing. But listener, wait, there's more. When you go to this link I'm going to include on this episode's website page at doitmarketing.com/selling, there are these bonuses, and I actually downloaded them. Now, this is for people who have bought the book, but at the end of the interview, because David is so demonstrably generous, he's going to share with you how you can download all of these things. And it's a lot of stuff, and even videos that you download and downloads from other authors and experts. It's just, it's way too generous. And he's going to tell you how you can download it without even buying the book. But come on, people, you need to buy this book. It's really good. So, but I'm not going to tell you just yet. See how that works? You got to keep listening. You got to listen to David's interview. So, but there's so much. My point is, there's so much that we could talk about in this interview. It could go on for hours or days. But I don't want to make my guests suffer like that. So we can really only scratch the surface. And so, David, this may be just a little bit frustrating for you that we can only touch on a few things. Given the
The biggest compliment, Douglas, when we did the Do It Marketing book interview, it was a fantastic conversation, and I think you gave that book the highest compliment it's ever gotten, which is unsummarizable. It was this book is unsummarizable because, unlike some books that maybe have 5 to 7 big ideas, there are lots of examples, lots of stories that illustrate those 5 to 7 ideas. As you said, all of my books have anywhere from 70 to 100 ideas because sometimes I sneak in a little extra.
You over-deliver. Stop it.
We over-deliver. So unsummarizable, if you call this book unsummarizable, I would be super happy as well.
Well, David, I forgot that I had said that. The memory goes first. You'll see.
Yes.
But that's a great example of this. And then it's like, and the other thing it doesn't have, for those that read a lot of these books, it doesn't have the same damn case study. There's about a dozen case studies that I keep reading over and over and over again. Some of them make sense because they're well-known companies, but that's not the case. This isn't it. So this book is for selling professional services, okay? But many of the things we're going to talk about, probably most, almost all, apply to really any kind of selling, whether you're selling business-to-business software. And not only that, we have lessons for marketers here as it relates to any kind of content you're creating. So listen carefully. I think I've only had one other book about selling professional services, which was very good, and it was called Selling Your Expertise by a guy named Robert Chen up in New York. And I'll include a link to his interview as well. I have a buddy who is a intellectual property attorney in Washington, D.C., who goes by the name of William Nixon. That's his real name. Nixon's the one, David. And he listens to the podcast, and I get the impression he's profited handsomely because he's done some of the things that the authors have recommended. And a while back, he was saying, what do you have for professional services? I said, oh, I got one coming up with Robert Chin. So William Nixon, this book's for you as well. So anybody in the D.C. area, actually anywhere in the world who needs an intellectual property lawyer, hire William Nixon, and I might get a bottle of wine out of it. So
I'm just going to add to that. Hello, Nixon.
That's right. Excellent. Speaking of that.
Hello, Newman.
Now, I want to read from the prologue here and then go on a whirlwind tour of the book.
In your hymnals, my friends, in your hymnals, please turn to page one.
Page one. Thank you, Reverend Newman. Now, you write, and this is just an example of the fun time you have reading this, the prologue. No. There, we got that out of the way. Everything you're expecting from another same-o, lame-o sales book you can throw out the window right now. No tired cliches, no empty promises, no sales 101 basic blocking and tackling. There are over 70,000 sales books currently in print, so trust me, you can find all that crap elsewhere in abundance. Ouch. Unlike those 70,000 sales books, I wrote this book for a very special person. You. The solo expert, the consultant, the executive coach, the corporate trainer, the professional speaker, the online course creator, the mastermind facilitator, the trusted advisor, the sage, the thought-leading professional services seller. You're a smart person with something to say and something to sell. If that's not you, then you have two choices. Put this book down right now. Oh, wait, there are still physical books? Two, read on and see what professional services sellers need to know and do, whether you're a company of one or 1,000. Don't. If you're still here, then chances are good that you don't have a sales manager, don't have a sales territory, don't have sales quotas, don't have a sales department, don't have sales meetings. And most importantly, as you decide if the juice is worth the squeeze for you to keep reading this book right now, you don't like sales. And it goes on like that for a couple hundred pages. So the first question I want to ask you, David Newman, explain what you mean when you write that sales success is slightly harder than it looks, but it's a heck of a lot easier than you've been making it.
Yes, 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 yes. Well, it's so funny. So I went through an entire beta reading process, and I had some things in this section of the book that you're talking about that were a little bit clunky, and I didn't quite say it. One of the beta readers says, David, in here, this is where you need to say one of my favorite David Newman phrases, which he's heard me say lots because he's a client. He says, this is where you need to say sales is a little bit harder than it looks, but it's a lot easier than you've been making it. And I'll tell you, this entire beta reading process, this is my third book. I've never done a beta reading process before. Invaluable. Invaluable. I had about 30 beta readers. They gave me amazing feedback. I took 80% of it and made changes, threw things out, things that I loved, things I thought were brilliant, things I thought were funny. They didn't get it. They didn't think it was funny. They thought it was either stupid or cryptic. So I took the stupid and cryptic stuff out. But this one is one that I forgot to put in, and a fantastic beta reader encouraged me to put that in. So here's what it means. Most professional services sellers, certainly most marketers, they look at sales as this like foreign, weird, disgusting. They kind of hold it up like a dead fish and they kind of hold it at arm's length and they go, ew, that's gross. I don't want to do that. And
I shouldn't have to do that.
I shouldn't have to do that, right? That's beneath me. That's not my job. Not what I'm not being paid for. That's not what I signed up for. So we make it harder than it needs to be. We overcomplicate. We overanalyze. We overparalyze. We overthink. We overfear. And we complexify. Maybe that's a good word. We complexify the sales process. Whereas really, if you boil it down, sales is nothing more than an invitation to a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And that humanizes the entire sales process, because generally we're not afraid of invitations. Invitations are usually good. Usually something fun happens on the other end of an invitation. We go to a party, we eat barbecue, we, you know, visit puppies, we, you know, rub people's heads and say hi and whatever. And then a conversation, once you're there at the party, most people are not afraid of a conversation. You meet new people, you exchange ideas, you get to know someone, you start to build a relationship. Maybe that relationship becomes commercialized at some point. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe that person becomes a referral source or an introducer. Oh, you should meet my brother-in-law. He's a fantastic marketer. He works at such and such. Who knows? But generally, no one's afraid of a conversation. So for the folks that are quote-unquote afraid of selling, which to me is silly, but they're, you know, I used to be there, so I totally get it. Mm-hmm. I think we need to replace the word sales and selling. Take those two words out of the equation and replace them with an invitation to a conversation with someone to see how you might help them. And that takes all the fear, all the hesitation, all the overanalyze, overparalyze, overcomplexify off the table.
There's another line in your book that I think would help people relieve the pressure they feel when you say that there's no one way to sell. There is only your way.
Yes, for sure. So this is the problem with a lot of bad sales trainers. I'm not going to say bad sales training, but certainly bad sales trainers and bad sales people is that they, you know, they've read a book and they are parroting phrases or scripts from a book that the author might have put in as an example or as a framework, but you're literally parroting the template. So think of any kind of sales template, and I really hate the word template, and I don't like the word script either. I believe in frameworks. I believe in models. Because think about, like, let's say you open up Microsoft Word, and there's a resume template, and you go, okay, file new, let's use the resume template. And it's job one, job two, job three, dates, 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 responsibility, responsibility, responsibility. Unless you customize that template, if you just print out that template and go, okay, here's my resume, I guess this is the template, you are going to look like an idiot. Because everyone needs to customize, tailor, and personalize that template to their own personal preferences, strengths, job history, expertise, experience, the job they're applying for, the person they're sending it to, their personality, their preferences, their strengths, God forbid, Douglas, if it's you and me, their own sense of humor,
oh, no,
and their own sense of humanity, and then you get a good resume. Well, how in the world are you going to get a good sales framework if that's not organic to who you are as an individual? So I think this personalization, customization, and tailoring, even the best sales scripts, and there's a ton of sales books, and some of them are good, and they have great frameworks and great models. But if we don't personalize those, they will not work for us. Because sales is not B2B, sales is not B2C. I think sales is P2P. Sales is person to person. Mm-hmm. You know, one of my early sales mentors said to me, because I was very hungry and very eager to learn, you know, all of these sales things about 15, 16 years ago, because I was a hopelessly lost salesperson. So I really decided to invest in some mentoring and invest in some good coaching. But he says to me one day, David, you are so concerned about being a better salesperson. Don't worry about being a better salesperson. Be a better person and more sales will happen. So I love that. I love that, because what does be a better person mean? That means actually care, actually listen, actually connect, actually provide value, actually be relevant to what your prospects and what your customers and clients really want. Serving before selling and helping before pitching is a key principle really throughout all of the do-it selling methodology.
And there just seems to be a shortage of it out there. This, you know, I mentioned earlier about Jeff Blunt getting hired by marketing people. In my advancing age, I'm starting to think or speculate that you know, companies will say, oh, our marketing's terrible. Yeah, maybe there's some things that you could improve on your marketing, but your sales is even worse. But they don't want to address that. They'll want to spend a bunch of money on a, I don't know, new website or something that they think is going to help. When yes. if they would just focus on some of the basics of sales first, I think they would have the greatest amount of traction.
You put your finger on something really, really important. So sometimes people ask me, so David, why'd you write this book? And I said, well, you look at the Do It Marketing book, that's about 30% sales content. And then I realized that people that were coming to me for help, it looks like it's a marketing problem, or they think it's a marketing problem. And I found that about 80% of these quote-unquote marketing problems are in fact, what you said, sales problems in disguise.
Yes, yes. And it's no surprise to me that you had Lee Sauls write an endorsement of your book. And his two books, Sales Differentiation and Sell Different, and I'll include links to those interviews, those are just phenomenal books. And in Sales Differentiation, which I think was the first one, he explains that there are certain things you can do to differentiate your company, and you should. But at least half of the differentiation of your company is how you sell. And it's an airtight argument. So things like that are helping me to understand. Now, before we move on from the head trash that listeners might have, there's one other thing I want you to talk about. You write that the two biggest obstacles to sales success are self-esteem and self-worth. Are those problems because people don't realize it, or they're not thinking about it, or what could they do?
Well, no, I think, you know, believe it or not, I do think people realize it. They might not know the distinction, and so I'll spend just a minute talking about self-worth versus self-esteem, because they're close, but they're not the same thing. Mm-hmm. They're not the same thing. So self-esteem is how you view yourself in isolation, like when you're alone, right? And the example in the book is, you know, you're singing in the shower and you're like, man, oh man, I'm you know, Taylor Swift, look out. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get that Grammy. I'm going to take that Grammy award this year. I'm an awesome, amazing singer. And, you know, you take that to the car, you get in the car, you're driving around and, you know, look out. You're a fantastic singer. You're awesome. You're amazing. So self-esteem is how we consider ourselves in isolation. Self-worth is where the problem is most of the time. Self-worth is now we're out in the marketplace. Now we're out in the workplace. Now we're in front of prospects and customers and clients. Self-worth is how you look at yourself in terms of the world. So this is where fear of judgment, fear of not being liked, fear of not sounding smart, fear of what will they think? Do I have broccoli in my teeth? I shouldn't have worn this shirt. Oh my goodness, I got dog schmutz on my pants from Gracie. Holy, everyone's going to see that when I walk into the meeting. And this is where we start to lose it. So the whole self-worth versus self-esteem, we have to work on ourselves. And sometimes this is an outside-in activity. And what I sometimes recommend to people is you got to have tangible sources of proof about your own fabulousness. So gather together your client success stories, your thank you notes, the thank you cards, the thank you emails, the thank you texts, every nice note that you've ever gotten from a previous boss, a customer, a client, a prospect, a past client, someone where you have had a tremendous impact on their personal or professional success, and remind yourself that you got it going on. Remind yourself that you are a valuable marketing or sales professional. Remind yourself of your track record of wins and successes. And on our worst days, because of course we have to sell, rain or shine, happy or sad, feel like it or not, but that extra dose of mental vitamins that you take from that kudos file and reminding yourself of all the gratitude, all the successes, all the wins, all of the clients and customers whose lives or businesses you've changed, that's the number one solution to fix that self-worth problem.
Don't bury your head in the sand, folks. Think about that. Now let's move on to something that I just see so often done wrong. And it could be with CEOs or sales managers, but basically it's companies in general. And this has enormous impact on the marketing. You write that the two most powerful words in sales are decide and define. Please help folks understand that. I think that seems to be one of the biggest stumbling blocks to success in sales and marketing.
Yes, 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 yes. Well, so decide and define is really about clarity. And if you look at every big brand, if you look at every successful company, the number one thing that jumps out is they know who they are. They know exactly who their clients and customers are. They know exactly what problems they're solving or what outcomes they're helping them create. So when you have that North Star, because certainly as if you're an entrepreneurial company or even a mid-sized company, there's going to be opportunities presented to you all the time. Hey, should we do this brand extension? Hey, should we open up a different location? Hey, shall we start a new division or a new product line? Hey, should we open up a new service offering to go in this direction or that direction? And if you are crystal clear and you've made some good, firm, solid foundational decisions, and you've defined exactly the kind of people you serve and exactly the kinds of problems you solve, number one, it keeps you on track. Number two, when distractions or opportunities come along that might be distractions, and let's say that you take a couple of left turns. When you go off track, what you've decided and defined, if you revisit that, it will get you back on track much, much sooner. So really, understanding who you're for and understanding who you're not for. Yes. That's what I mean by decide and define. I'll just close with a Tom Peters quote about this. It's a little bit of a mental pretzel, but I want you to listen carefully. This was on a Tom Peters calendar about 20 years ago. I tore it out, and it's still sitting on my desk right now. He says, choose damn carefully. His words, not mine. Sorry for the delicate listeners.
Don't worry. It's going to get worse, David.
Yeah, exactly. I think we've still kept our E rating for this episode.
That's okay. Going to change in a few minutes.
Yeah, go ahead. Exactly. So here's the full quote. Choose damn carefully because you are just as much about who your clients are not as about who they are. And man, when I read that, I was like, oh, sometimes you find yourself looking for love in all the wrong places. We should not be serving that kind of client. We should not be accepting that kind of project. We should not be doing that kind of work. We should get the heck out of this other industry that we thought would be a gold mine. It is taking us off mission. It is taking us off brand. It is taking us off purpose. And so that's what I mean by decide and define.
Yes. And one thing I have experienced in the past to get people thinking about this is to say, well, what kind of customers do you not want?
Yes.
And usually that gets the juices flowing and say, oh, these are not. Well, that's a good start. You know, as they say, you have to say no to grow. And a big part of business strategy is knowing who you are not a fit for and who you don't want to go after, even if it's a quick win. One more little trick that I loved in the book, one of several hundred, is it relates to selecting prospects. Explain what you mean by the best of the best are the ones who invest.
Yes, 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 yes. So this is something where I think even sophisticated sellers sometimes fall into this trap.
Oh, yeah.
So we look at who needs us the most? Who would immediately see what we're offering and they would say, oh my gosh, we have a giant problem in this area. We need this. We will pay for this. We suffer from this tremendously. We really need to fix this problem. And if seasoned people that maybe have been around the block a little bit will realize that sometimes the people that need you the most are the last ones that will ever buy. And it makes zero sense. It makes no sense. It still makes no sense to me to this day, but it's how the world works. So it's people who want your help. It is not people who need your help that are the very best kind of buyers. So how do we find the best? Well, luckily, in the last 20 or so years, we have this business institution that has come up around the best companies lists. So the best companies in every imaginable industry, the best companies in technology, the best companies here, the best companies there, the best companies everywhere. Sometimes best is even more specific. The most creative companies, the most forward-thinking companies, the best companies for diversity, equity, and inclusion, the best companies for young employees, the best places to start your career, the best places for, you know, working mothers. I mean, there is a zillion of these different kinds of lists, not to mention in your state, in your city. So if we start combing those lists, and I also want you to think about individual executives that you might want to sell to, because those people are going to be mentioned in lists like the CEO of the Year Awards, or the CFO of the Year Awards, or the HR Executive of the Year, or the Sales Executive of the Year. So the best of the best are the people, and this is the language that you have to use when you're thinking about how to approach them. You might think, well, they don't, this isn't an urgent thing for them. They don't need what we do. They're already doing great. Companies that are already doing great, here's the psychology of all of their top executives. They want to get ahead, they want to stay ahead, and they want to move ahead faster. In other words, they're driven by ambition. They're not driven by desperation. They are driven by success. They are not driven by fear of failure. So I think that's another big myth around the marketing and the sales world is, let's go in and find the pain. Let's beat them up. Let's hurt them. Let's find a spot where it's sore and push on that pain point. It's like, well, do you want clients who are struggling, or do you want clients who are successful? Do you want clients who are in pain, or do you want clients who are in this amazing forward motion and forward movement? So I'm going to quote the great Ray Kroc, the founder of the modern McDonald's franchise, the way we know it today. And someone once asked Ray Kroc, they said, Mr. Kroc, what would you say is the number one secret to your success? And he said, well, I guess the number one secret to my success is nobody ever walked into one of my restaurants who wasn't already hungry. So our job is to find that hungry target market, hungry but not starving.
Right. Yes. I love it. The prospects who need you the most will never buy. Now, listener, that was not in the book. So that what you just heard is a Marketing Book Podcast extra. You're welcome. Again, this kind of surprised me, but I think it's worth mentioning. As it relates to going after prospects, you write that your most underutilized prospecting asset is your warm network. How so?
Yes. Well, so think about the people that are already in your Rolodex. Kids, look it up. It's on Wikipedia. You'll get a chuckle out of it. But
can you believe people had those, David?
I know. And so the people that you already know, the people that already know who you are and what you do, you know, we're so hell-bent sometimes on talking to strangers, whereas the people that are already in your warm network,
they know you, they like you.
They know you, they like you.
They want to help you.
You emailed them yesterday, or you had a phone call with them last week, or you're having lunch with them tomorrow, and you don't think of them as potential connectors or influencers or strategic referrals. And so here's what you can do. Here's an exercise you can do right here, right now, as you're listening to this show, is open up your email, look at the last 30 or 40 people that you have emailed, texted, called, sent a message to on LinkedIn, sent a message to on Facebook. Look at your calendar. Who are the last 10, 12, 15 people that you've Zoomed with? And in that list, I bet that there are some potential clients. Maybe there's some past clients, or you could do a client reactivation strategy. Maybe there's some referrals and introductions hiding in that group. So think about this, that the people that are already connected to you, and the evidence of the connection is in your email outbox and your texting and your online social messaging. Why not reach out to them for a business development chat? Not necessarily to sell to them.
Right,
but
very important.
Ask, to enroll them in connecting with the people that you do want to be connected to. And the best way to do that is say, hey, Douglas, really great being on your podcast. You know, I'm looking to connect with more engineers that are in Silicon Valley. I would love your advice, insights, and recommendations. And that acronym, Advice, Insights, Recommendations, asking for AIR, A-I-R, A for advice, I for insights, R for recommendations. We talk about that in the book, and that comes from my friend Michael Goldberg, who is a networking expert. He has a fantastic book out there called Knockout Networking. But we're not having enough of these asking for AIR conversations with people that we're already connected to.
Yes, and they want to help you. I mean, I love being able to help people. You know, you get these emails from folks. It's like, oh, great. I'd love to be able to connect you. Kind of like when I hear from listeners around the world nearly every day, they'll say, hey, Douglas, what's a book I could read about this topic? I go, this one. Here's a link to the interview. It's like even that small amount of help makes you feel good.
Right.
People want to help you. So just a couple other quick questions. So you recommend having about 1,500 people as prospects in your CRM, David?
No. So we're big believers 10,000? In the active 20, my friend.
20?
20. Because 20 is manageable. 20 is realistic, right? So think about a written, and this is important because if you don't write it down, it's just in your head and that's not nearly as good. A written, workable list of 20, and not 20 companies, because people go, oh, I'd love to work with IBM, Merrill Lynch, PNC. No, 20 individual executives, people with names and faces and voices and noses and all kinds of body parts, 20 human beings that have actual LinkedIn profiles, email addresses, and phone numbers. And when you have a list of your active 20, these are 20 people that you are going to do an intentional, highly researched, relevance-based, value-based outreach campaign to get in front of. And what are you going to do? Just like we said in the early part of the interview, you are going to invite them to a conversation about how you might help them. Now, people will sometimes hear that part of it, Douglas, and they'll say, oh, you mean cold calling? Like, no, I don't mean cold calling. Cold calling is stupid. Intelligent prospecting is smart. So what separates cold calling from an initial conversation that is really valuable and likely to be accepted?
Value.
Three things. Value.
Oh,
yes. Value. That was a rhetorical question, my friend. But yes, value. Value, research, relevance. Thank you. Value, research, relevance. So have something to share with them. Have some insight. Do a little bit of research on what they're working on. What are some strategic initiatives? We all have so much research at our fingertips now. Salespeople of 25 years ago would literally kill for the internet capability and what's online at our fingertips, and they're still lazy salespeople. Nothing makes me more crazy than lazy salespeople. So think about, what can I find out about this company? What can I find out about this executive? Where were they interviewed? Let me look at the business journal in their city. Let me look at the business section of the major metropolitan newspaper that they're in. Let me search their name. Let me go to their website, go to the press release page, go to the media page, look at their product announcements, look at everything they're putting out there. Were they interviewed on a podcast? Were they featured on a YouTube video? Were they mentioned in one of the press releases? Were they mentioned in one of the local, you know, who's on the move and making moves in a certain industry? So you're going to check the trade and professional publications in that industry. You're going to search for these. This takes seconds for each and every one of these. And then you are going to show up with a highly researched, highly relevant type of outreach message that is totally customized and totally tailored to them. And by the way, folks, here's the test. If you can copy and paste that outreach message to 30 other prospects, it is not tailored. It is not customized. It is monkey spam. So do not send monkey spam. The email that you send to Douglas should be totally customized to Douglas's company and situation and research that you've done about his website and where his company's going. The email that you send to David should be totally customized to David's company and David's situation and what you read and what you researched about where David and David's company is going. So can it be a framework? Sure. But so the framework is the subject line needs to be something immediately relevant and valuable. So let's say I'm in the engineering recruiting business. The subject line might be David, shortage of engineering talent. Now, if I'm an engineering recruiter, that's going to get my attention. I'm going to open that email. And then it's a three-line email. Dear David, research from XYZ, in other words, credible source that they would recognize and respect. Research from XYZ shows that there's a shortage of bioengineering talent, and it's only going to get worse in the next quarter. My name is David Newman. I help, well, I can't be both the prospect and the seller in this case, but you know, my name is Susan Jones, and I help recruiting managers like you solve the talent shortage. Would this be worth a short chat? So I've customized it, I've tailored it, and I might even say, P.S., as I see you're expanding into the Midwest, because I'm a bioengineering company, right, this might be a problem. Let me know if you'd like to have a chat. So I found out that they're in the right industry, they have the right job title, I did research on their website, they're opening a new facility in Kansas City, here's the bioengineering talent shortage in the Midwest, would this be worth a short chat? And that is likely to get a response. That is likely to get a response.
You can explain that, but it's just so rare. So let's change it up a little bit. David, I know that you're a lover, not a fighter, but
let's get ready to rumble!
Let's talk about MMA.
Ooh, ouch, that really hurt.
Yeah. All right, here we go. You write that business success is about one thing, MMA. Hit me.
I just love that punch in the face sound effect so much. So MMA is, it's not mixed martial arts, despite what? The violent sound effects. I know. It is from my friend and mentor, Scott Simons, who taught me this over 20 years ago. And he looked me in the eye one day and he said, David, tell me about your MMA. And I was like, Scott, I wish I could, but what the heck is MMA? He said, MMA is the lifeblood of your business. MMA is money-making activity. And most people are not doing enough money-making activity, including me 20 years ago when Scott first shared that acronym with me. And MMA is what I call direct-to-prospect activity. So, for example, posting on something on LinkedIn is not MMA. Cleaning your office is not MMA. Doing client research is not necessarily MMA. MMA is how do you activate that research? What are you doing? What are you saying? What are you sending? How are you getting in front of that prospect? What next step do you need to take to bring them one step closer to a sale? And that's really the definition is, are we moving the ball forward? Are we moving the prospect one step closer to a check or a sale? And so let's just go down the example of the LinkedIn post. Writing a post on LinkedIn is not MMA. Sending a link to that post to three prospects that you're already talking to with a short note that says, hey, Barbara, I know last time we were talking about your employee retention strategies. I just wrote this piece on LinkedIn. Have a look at it and feel free to share it with your team. Looking forward to our call next Tuesday. So when you're taking something and actively putting it in front of a prospect to get them to the next step in your sales process, that is MMA. So MMA might be calls, texts, emails, Zoom calls, messages, Facebook Messenger, LinkedIn messages, shooting a quick 2-minute video to send to a prospect, updating something about a proposal that you're about to send. One step closer to a check is the bellwether for is that MMA. We have to remind ourselves, for example, that email is not our job. being on Zoom is not our job, right? Typing up stuff and sending content and blogging and tweeting and doing all this crazy stuff. Unfortunately, listening to podcasts is not your job either, but maybe being on a podcast is one of your sources of MMA, especially if you can send that podcast to a prospect and say, hey, this is one of my favorite podcasts. It's the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you very much.
Just heard this fantastic episode. I thought you'd get some value from it. Have a listen. Let me know what you think, right? You send that to an active prospect. You send that to a past client to invite a client reactivation chat at some point. But adding value and sending things and connecting with people who can give you money is MMA.
So it's not necessarily sharpening the axe, it's swinging the axe.
Yes.
There we go. Okay, so I've got to mention, because we have limited time, you've got this one wonderful chapter on some of the biggest prospecting mistakes. But what I want to do is ask you to expand on this, where you say not every prospect is a good prospect, not every good prospect is a good prospect for you. Explain why the better you are at client selection, the worse you can be at everything else.
Yes. Oh my gosh. So this comes, I'll tell you a quick story about kind of what turned the light bulb on in my brain for this one. So Peter Block, who wrote a fantastic book called Flawless Consulting, he's kind of the Yoda of the consulting profession. And he had worked for all of the major Fortune 500 companies, multi-six-figure, sometimes seven-figure consulting relationships. And I heard him speak at the Management Consultants Conference about 6 or 7 years ago. And there he is. He's got his white-haired, again, very sweet-natured. He's like the Yoda of the operation. And he gets up, and here's how he begins his speech. He says, you know, I've been consulting for 40 years. And in my opinion, I really don't have any specialized skills. And I spent the last 40 years working for terrific companies and amazing executives who didn't really need my help. And we're all looking around the room going, what do you mean? So he let that sink in, took about 3 seconds, and he had that little glimmer in his eye, just like Yoda has that little glimmer in his eye. And he's looking around kind of with that little smile on his face, and we're like, 40 years charging huge dollars, working with great companies and fantastic executives that didn't really need me. Oh, again, they wanted you. They didn't need you. They wanted you. So think about prospects, you know, that sometimes if our pipeline is empty, every prospect looks amazing. Every prospect is fantastic. And we end up violating some of our own guardrails and standards around who we are, what we do, what we're willing to do, what price and what fee we're willing to do it for. Whereas a rich pipeline makes you brave. Mm-hmm. And now you can be selective. Now you can be like Harvard, Yale, and Stanford, that it's literally an application process and you are interviewing. So you're the job interviewer. The job posting that you're trying to fill is my next client, but you're doing the interview and you're doing the selection. So I'm not saying that we're better than our prospects. I'm not saying come into this with a sense of arrogance or complacency, but come in with a sense of exclusivity. Come in with a sense of, just like an invitation to a party, you're not going to send invitations to random people that might come in and trash the room and eat all your food and steal the furniture and, you know, who knows what.
That's what my friends do.
Well, exactly. So the selectivity part, that's what I mean about not every prospect is a good prospect, and not every good prospect is a good prospect for you. If your pipeline makes you brave, then you can be like Peter Block, and you can selectively, you can interview prospects for who's going to fill that role of my next client, and you only want to work with clients who want you and not the ones who need you.
You included one of my favorite quotes from General Patton, which is a good plan violently executed now is better than a perfect plan executed next week. David Newman, back to the MMA violence. What is violent prospecting?
Oh my gosh. So this is about getting over perfection syndrome. Right? Oh, you know, we haven't updated the website yet. Oh, you know, yeah, it's like, oh, I got to fix my email signature file because that's not quite right. And yeah. I can't, you know, the pixels on my headshot there, that's not quite right. So we find every possible excuse not to engage in direct-to-prospect activity. So imperfect action executed consistently. So think about it this way. You can have the world's greatest strategy. If you never push the button, if you never implement, if you never execute, a strategy without execution is daydreaming. I would rather have you get into the fray, get into the mix, and like General Patton says, right, get into it violently, splash around, bump into some walls, break some stuff, and at least you're in conversation. At least you're on the field. At least you're making moves. So I think we got to get over this kind of hesitation. The least time that you can possibly spend in a state of hesitation in any area of your business, the more successful you will be.
Yes, a good plan violently executed now is better than a perfect plan executed next week. Oh, yes. I love it. I'm going to jump ahead to there's a great chapter on making the prospect feel safe. And this reminds me of my friend Mike Lieberman, who is the co-author of the book Smash the Funnel, which was featured on the podcast a few years back. And he's from Philadelphia, just like you. And he's a Philadelphia Eagles fan. And interesting fact, he's one of the few Eagles fans who has not been arrested at an Eagles game. Anyway, Mike has a wildly successful marketing agency in Philadelphia called Square 2 Marketing, and he always talks about the key to their success at selling their professional services has to do with making the prospect feel safe at all times. Talk about some of the ways that you can make your prospect feel safe.
So I think every prospect has now been sensitized to commission breath or sales breath.
Yes.
Where you are just like a hungry dog after a piece of meat and you have zero concern for, is this a fit? Will this actually help them? Is this something that would be wise to invest in? And you're just full steam ahead. Give me your credit card. Give me the check. I got to make this sale. I need to buy that boat. I don't care if this is a good fit for you or not. You're buying this thing and you're buying it today. So what's the opposite of that? The opposite of that is detachment. So detachment is, number one, truly you do need to be detached. So that's an inner game first. But how do we express that detachment? How do we make buyers understand that we're truly acting as a trusted advisor? And the definition of a trusted advisor is that you're holding the prospect's interests above your own. So you are a selfless seller. How do we convey that? Well, we say things like, well, you know, this is an area that you need to look at whether we decide there's a next step or not. And it's like, ooh, let's unpack that for a second.
Yeah.
Or not. Or not means, you know, you might, number one, you might want to solve this. You might not want to solve it. Number two, you might want to solve it with us and you might not want to solve it with us. And frankly, I'm good either way.
Yeah.
So I'm opening up the possibility that you're not going to buy from me. Now, notice I did not say you're opening up the possibility that I'm not going to sell your brains out. So me selling and you buying are two different things. When I start to open the door and say whether we decide to move forward or not, right, whether you decide to fix this or not, I'm putting the no option on the table. When you put the no option on the table, you will literally see, if you're on Zoom or if you're in person, you will see their body language change. You will see the shoulders will start to relax. They will start to lean in a little bit more because you're no longer this fire-breathing, crazed salesperson. So think about the, a couple of other phrases that would be this kind of tentative, conditional language, right? So here's what I recommend. Should you decide that you'd like to work together? If we mutually decide this is a good fit, whether we end up coming in to help you or not. So things like this peppered throughout your conversation, just naturally and organically, they're like, well, gosh, I sort of have the power here.
Yeah.
I can choose to move ahead or not. I can choose to move ahead with this person who's in front of me or not. And they seem like they're okay either way. And the more that you're – here's the irony of it. The more that you're okay either way, the more people will buy from you.
Right. I love it. And I've seen it so many times in my career where you sit down with somebody, let's say, and they're expecting a pitch, their guards are up. With all sincerity, I say, look, could we talk for a little while? Could I ask you some questions? Because I kind of need to figure out if we're a fit for what you need, because we're not a fit for everybody.
Right.
I always see their body language change and they're like, oh. It's just, it works so well. So always make them feel safe. It doesn't happen very much. There's a section in the book that is super relevant to marketers, but of course, everything in here is relevant to sales. And that's where I want you to explain what you mean. Sell the destination, not the transportation.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Well, marketers, we love our stuff. We love our methodology. We love our models.
We love our products.
Our mantras. We love our products. We love our technology. We love how it works and how it was invented and how brilliant and fantastic and innovative it all is. And you've heard this before, but I want to just anchor this in everyone's brain. Nobody cares. Nobody cares about the how. The how is the least interesting part of every single sales conversation. So in that part of the book, I talk about two different ways of selling a trip to Paris. Salesperson number one comes in and says, well, imagine that you're sitting on a balcony of a beautiful 5-star hotel. You're overlooking the Eiffel Tower. The sun is just rising over the horizon. There's a gentle knock on your door. The cart comes in with fresh hot croissants and beautiful, amazing cafe au lait. You get up and the love of your life is already out on the balcony and the croissants are out there and the fresh squeezed juice and the person that you're across from is just totally enamored of this entire thing and says, honey, you are the most amazing partner. Let's get married. I love you. I want to spend the rest of my life with you. That is one way to sell a trip to Paris, France. The other way is, oh, Paris, France. Well, let me tell you about the airplane you're going to get on. Holy smokes, this thing is a 787 super duper Dreamliner. And it is so much better than everything else from every other airplane manufacturer. It's got these Rolls-Royce engines that have 80,000 pounds of thrust. It seats 358 passengers. There is a kitchen galley. You should see the landing gear on this thing. It's got a triple axle super pneumatic. You get what I'm saying.
Oh, now, I was laughing out loud when I read this part. It goes on for an entire page with all this data.
I went nuts. And I researched this, by the way.
Yeah, you were talking about ailerons.
I talked about ailerons. I talked about the intelligent landing gear. I think it was some new kind of super high-tech Boeing jetliner that I researched. But anyway,
oh, yeah.
It is ridiculous when you say it this way. However, if you replay the last couple of conversations that you've had with your prospects, this is the listeners, of course, not Douglas, because Douglas is doing this right. Think about it. Have you spent too much time talking about the gosh darn airplane, the how we're going to get there, the methodology, the technology, the inputs, the how, the details, the models, the framework? No one cares about that. And did you spend nowhere near enough time talking about where they're going, what they're going to get, what they're going to experience when that problem is solved, when that outcome is delivered, what life is going to be like, what it's going to feel like, taste like, smell like, what is the ultimate destination of what they're trying to, either a problem they're trying to fix or a destination or a new outcome or a new accomplishment that they're trying to reach. It's our job as professional salespeople, by the way, to get them to that outcome, shorten the path, and accelerate the speed that they get to an outcome that they already know they want. The how and the mechanics of the airplane, completely irrelevant and ridiculous when you use it in this analogy. And it's just as ridiculous when we do it, talking about what we do instead of what they get and what they will experience.
Yes, 1,000 times yes. And again, people should sell the destination, not the transportation. And what came to mind was the next time, let's say there's a marketer and they're sitting down with their, maybe their engineers or their product people, and they go, no, you got to talk about the product. Bring this story up and see what happens. See if you can help get them to come around to focusing more on the destination. There's always time to talk about the transportation, but not first. So, David, I don't want to fight, but I do want to get negative with you.
Hello, Newman.
You write that one way to surface the buyer's hidden motivations, urgencies, or buying triggers is to use go negative questions. I love this. Explain.
So sometimes we find ourselves, chasing, persuading, convincing, cajoling. This is the opposite of that. So we talk about discovery questions. We're in the discovery questions section of the Do It Selling book. Whenever someone says, we want to fix this problem or we want to get this outcome, you want to go into strategically dumb and perpetually curious mode. And you want to ask questions. And the go negative questions that you can ask are things like, well, what if you don't do anything? What if you just kind of leave this alone? What if nothing changes?
Yes.
And, one of my favorite ones, this is all about your come from, by the way. So your come from, you need to be genuinely curious, because if you ask these questions in a flippant way, you really sound like a jerk.
Yes.
So one of the ones that if you're genuinely curious and your come from is really to help the prospect, here's one that I really love. Well, Douglas, don't you find that a lot of times these problems just fix themselves?
Yeah, kind of like medical problems.
Right.
If you ignore them long enough.
Yeah, the horrible cancer diagnosis, eventually that'll fix itself because you'll be dead.
Yeah.
So think about, but literally, because what's our competition? Our competition rarely is another competing company or firm that does what you do.
Right,
it's
no decision.
The biggest source of competition is do nothing or
yes.
No decision, exactly. Mm-hmm. So what if you don't do anything? I'm curious, what's the downside of that? Don't these problems really generally fix themselves? What are the consequences of letting it go? And the intent behind all of these questions is to really get your prospect in a frenzy and for them to say some variation of, hell no, no, it can't continue. No, it can't stay the same. No, it's not going to fix itself. No, we have to fix this now. We can't wait. Well, I'm curious, what if we just wait 6 months? Can we put this off? I mean, I'm curious, what's the big deal about solving this now? But again, you can't ask it. I'm giving it to you quickly now. You really have to slow down here. And you really have to check your come from, because you don't want to come off sounding like a jerk. This is the Columbo strategy.
Yes.
And again, Columbo, you got to go back, kids. Look it up. It's on Wikipedia. It's on YouTube. Old Rumpled Detective, right? This is a show from the 1970s. And everyone would underestimate this guy. That was his superpower. Because he came across as a little bit dumb and a little bit rumpled. He was incredibly intelligent and incredibly observant. So he would just about be leaving the arch villain's big mansion. His hand is on the doorknob. And he turns around in this kind of rumpled, shruggy kind of way that he has. And he goes, sir, I'm sorry. I forgot to ask one small question. It's a minor detail. minor detail. You said that you went up the stairs at midnight, but they actually found the body at 11:37 p.m. It's like, da-da-da, busted, busted. And why did Columbo always get the bad guy? Because he listened. Mm-hmm. He listened to every detail. He observed every detail. He asked the right questions in the right sequence. And everyone thought this guy was just clueless and rumpled and silly and paid him no attention. He posed no threat. And that's also the magic of these go negative questions. You want the prospect to say, oh my gosh, absolutely unacceptable. We have to fix this. It's a giant problem, and we have to fix it now. How soon can you start? Because if we minimize it, they maximize it. And the urgency coming from them, prospects don't argue with their own data
yes.
and their own opinions.
Yes. You know, I stumbled upon this years ago. I'm sure I had learned it in, you know, you learn it going through sales training, but then until you apply it or try it, you finally realize, wow, those people really know what they're talking about. Back in my ad agency days, I had been contacted by this big electrical cooperative here in Virginia, basically a monopoly. And they needed something. They were getting ready to merge with another big one or whatever. And I remember I was talking to the CEO, and I just thought, in my mind, I didn't understand why they needed to, you know, do a bunch of advertising and all this sort of thing, even though that would have lined my pockets. But I said, well, what happens if you don't do this? What happens if you don't do what you want to do here? Because I really thought it didn't matter. And he launched into this long explanation of the perils he faced if he didn't do it. He basically sold himself. And it was like, oh, that's what they're talking about. So
exactly. Yes. I love that.
You know, you also talk about you should really never try to sound smart on a sales call, which seems so counterintuitive. But explain why you should not try to sound smart, why it's okay to be, you know, what seem like a dumb person.
Well, it's really the two killer things for most sales professionals and most professional services sellers in particular is wanting to be liked and wanting to sound smart. Mm-hmm. And the moment we let go of those two impulses, which are totally natural, that is the moment that we start to really elevate and escalate our sales success. So let's talk about wanting to sound smart. When we want to sound smart, we automatically assume that when someone says something like, well, you know, our employee retention numbers aren't where we would like them to be, or we'd like to increase our employee retention numbers. If you're a seasoned consultant, executive, someone who solves that problem, you go, okay, got it. Sure. No problem. We do that all the time. We've done it for client one and client two and client three. I totally get what you're talking about. I totally get where you're coming from. If you think about this, you have zero data whatsoever. So don't sound smart. Someone says something like, we'd like to improve our retention numbers, or our retention numbers are not where we'd like them to be, right? Pretend it's the first time you've ever heard that statement come out of any prospect's mouth. And there should be like, I don't know, 17, 19, 27 more questions that you want to ask about that. Well, I'm curious, where are your retention numbers now and where would you like them to be? Now, typically, they will kind of come in and they might be a little bit guarded and say, well, they're just lower than we would like. And a lot of people leave that, okay, got it, they don't want to share it with me. I need to know the numbers, Douglas. I need to know the math behind this. What does lower than you would like look like? And then the magic phrase that would quantify and specify all these follow-up questions is, can you put a number on it? 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 So I need to know, where's the retention number now? Where has it been historically? Where would you like it to be? Tell me about the retention numbers that you have compared to your competition. Do you know if you're ahead of the competition, behind the competition, same as your competition? What have you done to try and fix it? What did that cost? How did that work? How long did that take? How much time before you saw, oh, did that move the number up? Did that move the number down? So literally, you're telling me our retention numbers aren't where we would like. I have 29 follow-up questions, and maybe that's an exaggeration, but I need to quantify and specify what that means. So you do not sound dumb when you ask those questions. You would sound dumb, or you would act dumb, if you did not ask those questions. Right. And then the other thing is, well, think about being liked, right? Being liked, a lot of times it's like, well, let me show them how valuable and how personable and how wonderful I am. And so you start making statements, or you start giving little Band-Aid pieces of advice because you want to be liked. And rather than do that, I would ask better, more questions. I would stay in the conversation longer, because as far as that likability factor, they like you more when they are talking. They do not like you when you are talking. And rapport is built when they are talking, and trust is built when they are talking, not when you are talking. And then the final point on this is, prospects will always judge us far more on the questions that we ask than on the statements that we make. So what's a high number to you is not a high number to them. And when we need to dig in and specify and quantify and put numbers on where their problem is, where it's been, where they'd like it to be, this is where you can start to justify premium fees maybe much higher than you thought of charging before, because no one's willing to spend $50,000 on a problem that doesn't have a price tag on it. Everyone is happy to spend $100,000 on a $5 million problem.
Yes, and I want to get to that. So I think when you're there and you're talking to prospects, it's okay to channel your inner Forrest Gump.
I'm not a smart man.
Now, David, earlier you mentioned monkeys, and I want to go back to monkeys. You talk about that when we do sales to our prospects, it's about as effective as putting on a dancing monkey show. And it brought to mind a quote from Anthony Iannarino, who wrote The Lost Art of Closing, where he said, selling isn't something you do to someone, it's something you do for someone and with someone. So yeah. Talk about how you get prospects to actively engage in your sales process. And folks, this has all kinds of implications for the marketing people too.
Yeah, no, this is huge. This is about having an active prospect, meaning the prospect is not sitting back in the chair, arms crossed, saying, show me what you got, I'll give you 10 minutes, right? Totally puts you on your back foot, totally puts you in an inferior vendor and peddler position.
Yeah, waste of time.
So exactly. So what you want is you want to send the prospect something that before that conversation occurs, they are responsible for reading something, doing something, filling something in, watching something, listening to something, no matter how small. And my recommendation is not to make it too small, but to make it small-ish. So think about, what could you send to a prospect that would predispose them positively to the next conversation that you're about to have? So a questionnaire, an online assessment, a quick worksheet, some kind of little 3-minute, 5-minute, 7-minute video that they can watch. Not about you. So let's be clear on what all these things are. Oh, should I send them a PDF brochure? No. Should I send them like a video that's our latest infomercial? No.
That's a dancing monkey show.
That's the dancing monkey show, right? That's you trying to persuade and convince and cajole, and look how awesome we are. It's something that they can use to generate an insight about their own situation or circumstance or condition. Mm-hmm. So think about, it's something that will, they can fill out a survey, they can read a PDF that they can identify with some of those problems and some of the solutions that they might like to have in that PDF. They can do a self-scoring assessment where it's like, well, out of 100 points, you just scored a 38. So now there's a 62-point gap, and you're about to talk to Douglas, and one of the things he might share is you got a 38%. Let's see if we can fill the gaps in some of these other areas. Mm-hmm. They can watch a video. The video can be some combination of insight and recommendation and identification of clients and prospects that are similar to themselves, where they can see themselves in that circumstance or that situation. And then here's the test, because some people take half my advice on this, and sadly, half my advice doesn't work. They get on the call. Did you have a chance to watch the videos? Did you read the PDF? And Douglas, you and I had this even coming onto your show. You do pre-work. The guest does pre-work. And we're doing this together right now, you and I, as a collaborative, fun activity. But if I hadn't done the pre-work, if I hadn't watched the videos, if I hadn't read the spec sheet and the tech sheet, it's like, oh, this is not happening. We're not doing this, right? So here's the question to ask. Did you get a chance to watch the video? Did you get a chance to download the PDF? What did you think? What were two or three of those items that really jumped out at you as relevant to you and your company? Which of those three or four problems did you most identify with in that article? And now you have an educated prospect. Mm-hmm. More importantly, you have an involved prospect. Yes. You have an engaged prospect. You have someone who is playing ball with you, not someone who is sitting back saying, hey, you got 10 minutes, show me your stuff. So truly a collaborative sales process, co-labor. You need to do the work, and the prospect needs to do a little bit of work. That's collaboration.
Yes, and because this is a podcast about books, I'm allowed to mention books. So there was a book on the show a few years back by James Muir called The Perfect Close. And he talks about the process, but everything through there is basically pitching the ball to the prospect, getting them to react, getting them to be engaged. That's one part of the process he talks about. And there's another book where a great example of this is mentioned in Marcus Sheridan's book, They Ask You Answer, second edition. I'm sure you've run into him on the speaking circuit. What they did at their pool company is they had the same question all the time when they would go visit somebody who wanted them to come make a sales call and talk to them about installing a pool. So what they did finally is they had a little ebook about what you need to know about buying a fiberglass pool. You know, very helpful. It wasn't about them. Like, this is when it's not, doesn't make sense to buy one of our pools, that kind of thing. And the other thing is they had a little video that they'd made over the years, could have been made with an iPhone, and it said, here's kind of the process. You know, first we get down payment, then we get permits approved, then we dig a hole. Basically, they cut together, this is kind of bring the future to the present. They'd show that. But what they did is somebody would call to schedule an appointment. They'd say, great, we'll come out on that Friday. And they'd say, now listen, we're going to call you back the day before the appointment. And if you haven't had a chance to read the ebook or watch the video, that's fine. We'll just need to reschedule. Yeah. And he said maybe four or five people over the course of several years ever balked, which immediately told them, well, this isn't a good prospect anyway. But more importantly, when they call on these people, they were closing at a 79% rate. So almost 80% of all their visits closed. And one day, Marcus showed up at the house, and a little boy looked out the window after he knocked on the door, and they said, Mom, Dad, it's the guy from the video.
Nice.
Yeah. So it's one of my favorite topics, and it's something where marketing folks can play a big role. David, there are so many more things that I had. I actually had 8 pages of questions, so we're going to skip over those. Just wanted folks to have a sense of what was in there. But there was one last thing I wanted to talk to you about, and that is, you touched on earlier, you have several chapters about what to charge clients, and people generally don't charge enough, and they're afraid to ask for more, which kind of takes us back to the self-worth topic we talked about earlier. And one approach that helps people get past that is what you call the context of value and the contrast of scale. Can you explain what you mean by the context of value and the contrast of scale? I found that it's one of the most powerful approaches.
Yes, absolutely. So this is about, this kind of ties together a couple of the concepts we've been talking about. Number one is to specify and quantify the scope and scale and depth of the problem. Can you put a number on it? What does that mean in terms of dollars, etc.? And then all of these numbers, by the way, they come from the prospect. So a very important part of this is when you're establishing the context of value, meaning what's it worth to solve this problem? What's it worth to get this outcome?
And right. Then the and actually, David, scale. let me interject. It's almost back to where you said our retention numbers aren't where they need to be. Well,
yes.
That would probably be a dozen more questions to start to get to some numbers. And then they start to realize, oh, this is a $2 million a year problem. We didn't think of
yes.
it that way.
Exactly. Exactly right. So this is something where we need to very specifically put numbers on the table, and the numbers have to come from the prospect. Because again, prospects don't argue with their own data.
Yep.
If you show up and you say, well, you know, with most companies, it's about a $4 million problem. Immediately you've lost it, because that's not relevant. That is not customized. That is not anything to do with their situation. So always use their numbers and always ask what their numbers are. Because at that point, right, when you're looking at this is literally a $7 million problem, according to them. According to them. They did the math. They helped you with the math. You asked the prompting questions, but they filled in the blanks. And their math is, it's a $7 million problem. And you say, well, I have great news. Based on everything you talked about, based on everything we shared, the best solution is going to be somewhere in the range of $250K. Now, imagine putting a $250K proposal on the table to solve a $7 million problem versus you didn't ask any of the data questions. You didn't ask any of the numbers questions. You didn't ask any of the dollars questions and say, so you're going to come in and fix our retention problem. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, that's great. How much is that? Well, you know, most of our projects come in around $250,000. Oh my God, are you kidding? No, we thought this would be like 20 grand. 250,000? Are you insane? We've never spent $250,000 on something like this. What are you, a consultant? Oh my, no. So any number without a context is a number that is too high,
yes.
Right? 250,000, if I don't know what I'm getting for that, I'm not going to hire you. I'm not going to buy that. When I just told you, however, that I have a $7 million problem, according to me, I'm the prospect. I'm telling you, well, gosh, I never thought about that. But yeah, that's $7 million that it's costing us to have this problem. David, I have great news. It's only $250K. I'm going to breathe a sigh of relief. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's so great. Listen, when can you start? When can you start solving my $7 million problem for a one-time investment of $250K? That's what I mean by the context of value, right? What's the payoff? And the contrast of scale is, oh my gosh, this is a 28-to-1 return on investment. I put $250,000 in the machine, and the machine returns to me $7 million. I'll take that deal all day long.
Yeah.
If you don't have the money conversation, you'll never be able to have the fee conversation.
Amen. Well, David, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
I'm going to go back to something that we shared early on about be a better person, care more, listen more, ask more, commit more to your prospect success, and do that in a way that is detached and cool and calm and no sales breath, no commission breath, and be a better person.
But David, that's hard. No, I'm kidding. It's so true. Everything else starts to take care of itself, just like you mentioned earlier on. So let's give the listener one thing they could do today as soon as they stop listening to this to put in action one of the ideas from your book.
Jump on Google, look for the best companies in the industry that you target.
Ah.
So let's say it's pharmaceutical. Mm-hmm. Best companies for pharmaceutical executives, best companies in Seattle or Denver or Orlando or Paris or Belgium or wherever, it's global, right? Best companies, CFO of the year, CEO of the year, executive of the year in that particular industry, and start to get your list together, because the best of the best are the ones who invest.
Amen. Oh, such great advice. Well, are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or looking forward to reading?
There is, and I am going to share a really cool book. It is a fun read. It is a quick read from Diana Kander and Tucker Trotter called Go Big or Go Home, 5 Ways to Create a Customer Experience that Will Close the Deal. It is like an espresso shot. It is a small book. It is a tight book. But if you really want to close big deals with big companies, land those whale clients, definitely recommend Go Big or Go Home.
Great recommendation. I have a copy of that book. I've extended an invitation to her. I hope she schedules it. It looked really good. I started reading the first part. I hope she'll come on. So at marketingbookpodcast.com, we'll include links to everything linkable. And there's been a lot of things linkable that have been mentioned. All the books you've mentioned, your site. You've got 2 sites, as a matter of fact, your LinkedIn profile, your Twitter account, and we're also going to include a link where all the listeners, without even having to buy the book, but you should buy the book, can download all the bonuses. David Newman, tell folks how they can download all those resources, and it's a lot. I downloaded them yesterday. Well, I downloaded as much as I could, but it's all there. Keep the email. Don't get rid of the email when you get it.
Yes.
Tell them.
So here's where you go, marketing book podcast people. Go over to doitselling.com. There's going to be a link there that says get bonuses. You're going to click on that. Ordinarily, it would ask you for your information and your Amazon receipt number, but you don't need to buy the book, as Douglas said. Instead, where it says receipt number, put in the magic keyword marketing. Marketing. And you will get to eat dessert first, because you will get all the companion tools, all the worksheets, all the downloads, and all the training videos that go with the Do It Selling book. If you want to pick up the Do It Selling book later, that's fine too. But you get to eat dessert first, because you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
I just looked up generous in the dictionary. There's a picture of David Newman there.
Hey!
You've been very generous with your time and all your resources. And now a word to you, dear listener. I want to ask you a big favor. Please reach out in some way to David and congratulate him on the book. Thank him for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. Send him a message on LinkedIn or Twitter. Just go to one of his websites and sign up. And guests on the show have told me that they really enjoy hearing from Marketing Book Podcast listeners. And not just because Marketing Book Podcast listeners are so ridiculously good looking. But wait, on page 267, David Newman even writes, "For the record, I would love, love, love to hear from you. And I answer every reader email, so please don't hesitate to drop me a line." His email is david@doitmarketing.com. Come on, folks. Help him out. This can't be his last book. I want him to come back. And if you, listener, are listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app like Spotify or Apple Podcasts, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. The book is Do It Selling, 77 Instant Action Ideas to Land Better Clients, Bigger Deals, and Higher Fees. The author is David Newman. David, thank you very much for returning to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Douglas, pleasure to be with you, my friend.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who have left an iTunes review, please let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I'll drop it in the mail. And remember the words of the entrepreneur, author, and motivational speaker Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune."